This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Thank you for joining us.
The pleasure's all mine, Russ.
Well, welcome back to campus. We're so delighted to have you here. I wonder if you could tell us, what was the inspiration for this film, and when did you first begin writing it?
Well, oh man, this really is wild to be up here on this stage in this capacity. It feels very professional. The inspiration for this film, well, I started writing this film in May of 2020. I had been working full-time in film and TV development before that, and I knew I needed to write a feature script, and I really wanted to, but I was very, very, very busy. I'd been working full-time. I had networking drinks, dinners, lunches every day. I was supposed to be reading like 8 to 15 scripts per week. And then the pandemic happened, and suddenly I had way more time than I was used to, and so I knew I needed to write a script. And then I found out about a filmmaking competition called the Six Feet Apart Experiment, which I know I think we're going to get to. But I wrote this script specifically for that competition. And I was back home with my family at the beginning of the pandemic. So spending a lot of time thinking about how much my family meant to me, thinking about this desire to be a creator, but not knowing what to do with that impulse. Thinking about nostalgia in this sort of like very strange, uncanny moment of the world getting turned upside down during the pandemic. And so I started just writing down bits of inspiration from there. And I was excited about the idea of using VHS. I had previously made a short film that was all on VHS, and I thought, okay, that's like an asset that I have. And maybe if I could figure out a way to use that thing that I have previously told a story on, maybe that will help me stand out for this competition. And I just kept working backwards from the pieces that I liked, and I ended up at this story.
So you submitted to the competition, and how do you, what happens there, and how do you get this film made?
Yeah, so this was made through this competition called the 6 Feet Apart Experiment, which was from, there's a company called Wayfair Studios, which is the filmmaker, actor, producer, Justin Baldoni's company, which people may know now from this movie, It Ends With Us, because they just made that film, which was, I think, their first wide release theatrical movie. They're also going to be doing the Pac-Man movie. They're getting bigger and bigger right now. But they announced that they were going to be doing a very unusual competition in the pandemic, where they were looking for 5 filmmakers with scripts that could be made for budgets of $50,000 or less, which is a really, really, really small budget. Even though it sounds like a lot of money, that's very, very, very micro. And so that just became my full-time focus. And so I started writing in May. I mostly wrote in June and July. Submitted, got accepted in August, and we were in production by November. So it was a really rapid life change that has definitely influenced the course of the rest of my life, for sure.
So beyond the great writing and your filmmaking, one of the things that really makes The Moon and Back wonderful is the casting. I wonder if you can tell us about the casting and the casting director that kind of put these incredible actors together for you. And who are these actors? Because some of us recognize them. I'm curious if you could tell us something about them.
Yeah, absolutely. It's an amazing cast. We got so lucky in terms of cast. I didn't initially want to hire a casting director. We were working with no money. Every single line item needed to be like very thoroughly examined because we had very limited resources to stretch. But I was connected to a casting director named Brett Howe, who similar to myself, because at the time you look at where I was in my life, like I had just moved to LA about 3 years before. Me and all my friends were assistants or had just been promoted out of assistants or were trying to become coordinators or trying to kind of act at a level above what we actually were, trying to find ways to be perceived as adults, but barely creeping into our adulthood. And I got connected to this casting director named Brett, who had been the assistant to one of the highest level casting directors in the business, which is Mary Renew, who runs this casting company called Betty May Casting. They cast Euphoria, they cast Silver Linings Playbook, they cast, those were the ones that were relevant at the time, so that's what I always remember, but they do really, really big movies. And he had just been promoted to casting director, but he had no casting credits. And it was the perfect person to work with on the film because he was so well connected and allowed us to audition people at really high levels and call agents that would never have called me back. And when they wouldn't call him back, he could get his boss on the phone to go call agents that would have to return her phone calls because she's casting big movies. So he really expanded access for us. And we had some crazy, like, it's funny, the list of people that auditioned or that I met with, there were some big names that we were toying with for a while. So we got, I will also say too, this is like a secret story. It's been a while, but so maybe it's okay to share. But the first actress that we sent an offer to before we went to auditions was an actress named Storm Reid, who's a big, she was also in Euphoria, she was in a bunch of things. We met, she really liked the script, she wanted to do it. We couldn't get a deal done because of her reps and her manager, and we went to auditions, and this was about 2 weeks before production. And that's a really big challenge because depending on who you cast as your main actress, you're casting a family. So you can't really cast the rest of the family until you know who your main actor is gonna be. So it was really stressful. And not only that too, but we had to cast with enough buffer for COVID testing because it was still like in the throes of the pandemic. So we went back to tapes 2 weeks before, dug through people that had been sent, and Isabel really stood out for Lydia. She had been in a Netflix show called Alexa and Katie. She played Katie in Alexa and Katie, but she hadn't really broken out as an adult actress yet. This was like a Netflix, more like teen show. And we called her back and she got the role, and it's been amazing to watch her trajectory since then, because right after this she got Taylor Sheridan, wrote a role for her on Yellowstone 1883. So she became the sort of breakout star of the Yellowstone prequel, and now I just saw today she's going to be in Scream 7. She switched agents. We're going to see a lot of Isabel in the next couple of years. So Brett did an amazing job helping us find her. Miles, who plays Simon, if anybody saw the Smile 2, he has a big role in Smile 2. He has a role in Agatha All Along. He has like a big featured part. And then, of course, there's legends. Like, I'm really rambling on about this, but I get excited because they're very talented. Missy Pyle is a legend, has been in so many funny things, got cast 2 days before. Same with Nat Faxon. Missy specifically, I had a call with my casting director. I emailed my casting director back. He wanted to go to somebody else as a backup to Missy. I write him back at midnight going, is there anybody else? And he called me. We had a midnight 12:30 a.m. phone call going, Leah, you're just out of time. Like, we have to keep moving. We have to get this done. And the next morning, Missy said that she would do it. So it was really, really, really down to the wire. And same with Nat as well. And then PJ Byrne auditioned, and he was fantastic. He was so funny, and you'll see him in lots of he's like does funny roles in like Martin Scorsese movies and stuff like that. So
in addition to me, there are some of your other old professors here, and they probably like me recognize some of the names in the crew. I'm curious just who were some of your UCSB colleagues that you worked with, and tell us a little bit about how you came to bring them onto this film.
Yeah, there were a couple UCSB people in our credits. There was Mika Pham was our script supervisor. She'd never done that before, but we connected her with a veteran script supervisor. They hopped on a Zoom. He taught her how to do it, and she showed up, and she was fantastic. Harrison Wayne and Stephen Lee were both B camera or an assistant camera operators. They were great. I also just shot a documentary with Stephen, so we still work together all the time. And then there's also some other UCSB names in the special thanks. Keenan McGuckin helped me do script revisions. I was always pulling from that network for this.
So you shot this in 9 days. You cast it at most of the people toward the last minute.
Yeah.
How do you cohere a cast like that with such intimacy that you need on the screen? How do you get them together to create the sort of family, as you describe it, with such little time?
It was hard. Yeah. And I think I owe, especially as a first-time director doing this, so much of the quality of the film goes back to having great actors. I did the best I could in limited time. I had lunch with Isabel, I had lunch with Miles, and then we got to do one rehearsal before the shoot, and it was the pandemic, so we couldn't really go inside. It was a little murky in terms of COVID protections. So we went to a park, and we walked through some of the scenes together, and I remember I was thinking about this when we were backstage. I haven't told this story in a long time, but when we went to the park, we had a bizarre experience where a bird first shit on my shoe, and then another bird shit on Miles, and then a third bird got Isabel, and then we realized that we were under a bird's nest.
It wasn't just good luck.
Yeah, we walked away from it going, that was so bizarre. But I think it's good luck. Like, I think this is auspicious for the film that we're about to shoot. So they were great. They were down for everything. And then for the older actors, I learned so much about how they were such pros. And they would come in with 10 different improv lines, and they were really, I think, casting funny people that can be funny together. You almost just want to put them in a room together and let them cook and give them room to do funny things, because so much of, especially in the beginning when Nat is still in the movie, so much of that is just them building on each other.
So the beginning of this film is just beautiful with all the kind of nostalgic videotape and desktop computers, small town life, bake sales. There's an Easter egg in the videotape. Can you tell us who's the baby in this film?
So I actually play the baby in this movie. So when we were shooting the opening montage, it's shot very straight. It's shot very to script. And when my editor and I were working in post, we felt like it was missing something. Like it needed a more organic feeling. It needed texture. It needed to feel like it was pulled from somebody's life. So we dug up our own home movies and tried to pull shots where we didn't look too brunette to play Lydia or to, you know, just things that didn't seem like they were outside of the texture of the movie too much. So all the baby videos are of me, except for the one newborn shot is my editor at the hospital.
You know, the film's about a woman who discovering that she's going to be a filmmaker and how much filmmaking means to her. I would be remiss if I didn't ask the cliched question of, did you always know you wanted to be a filmmaker? Mm-hmm. When did you know you wanted to be a filmmaker? Was it when you got to UCSB? There's a good answer. I would love to hear it.
I think you know what you're
saying. Yeah, but I'm leading you to it. So
I did not know that I wanted to be a filmmaker when I was in college, or growing up at least. I grew up acting. And I always loved movies, but I didn't know how that was supposed to translate into a career. And then my freshman year, I got to UCSB and I had no idea what I wanted to do, what I wanted to major in. I was totally lost, and feeling really like I didn't have any roots under me. And then I took a film class. It worked out for the best, but I'm sure the same would have happened. If
absolutely,
it were
of course.
In fact, it was actually Anna Bersuti's class, who's here tonight. legendary UCSB professor. But I took Film 46, and it really clicked for me. Like, I really had always had this passion for movies that just felt like something that I found a lot of joy in, but I didn't, Nobody had ever shown me all the different ways that you get to participate in it. And not only that, too, but I loved the experience of being in a classroom environment analyzing why movies work, why they're culturally important, why things resonate, like what cultural underpinnings were behind like these projects from different times. And so it was just really exciting. And then I think the rest of college for me was just a kind of blossoming of learning all the other ways that I could be involved and figuring out where the passion was going to take me and what parts of it I liked the most. And I spent most of college wanting to be a producer. And then it wasn't until spring quarter of senior year that translated into directing, because I can give other professors shout outs. First I took Chris Jenkins' green screen. That was my first time directing a film project. And so I made a documentary called The Believers. And then I did a couple other little things. We were doing the film co-op. And then my spring quarter senior year, I took 108 with Dana. And I was doing 10-10-10 at the Santa Barbara Film Festival concurrently. And it just all came together, where for the first time in that class, I was making something where I had an idea, and my crew and I had enough experience to execute it at the level that I had conceptualized it. And I'd never had that experience before. And the feeling of being on a set that is clicking, where I know what I'm doing, and I feel like I'm making something great I had never experienced before. And I remember driving home and calling my parents and going, guys, I got bad news. I think I want to be a filmmaker. Let's see what happens with that.
Filled with both pride and fear.
Yes, yeah, very much so.
So a question for you, and we have a lot of students here, and I'm interested to tell, if you could tell them, what was the path after graduation? Because, you know, everyone has this path, and you find out, especially when you get out of college, that everyone's path is circuitous and crazy and strange. What was your bizarre but wonderful path to the agency world and into development and everywhere else?
Yeah. Well, my first job after college was at CAA, which is a creative artist agency. It's one of the sort of big three talent agencies that represent all kinds of entertainment people all across the business, whether it's on screen, behind the camera, sports, influencers, writers, like they really do it all. They're really at the center of the entertainment industry. I got that job because I had a friend that I worked with at UCSB named Aurelio Lopez, who was a year above me, and we did the film co-op together, and he had been an intern before me. And he knew I wanted to work at CAA because I had talked about it throughout senior year, and I was doing things like Women in Media, where people were telling me, go work in a talent agency, have that experience. And so when his internship was wrapping up, he said, hey, do you want me to put your resume in? And I said, yes, absolutely. And that's how I got that job. I didn't have some senior agent USC connection, whatever, although there was an agent at the time there who repped Jennifer Lawrence named Jeremy Plager, who was a UCSB alum, and we did get to bond over that. But yes, that was my first job, was being in the mailroom at CAA, which is a very classic job. And then from there, it becomes a lot easier once you're at a talent agency to work at other entertainment companies. So I got a junior development executive job at this action movie company called Solstice Studios, and made a movie called Unhinged with Russell Crowe, where Russell Crowe has road rage and chases a woman down and kills a lot of people in her family. So that was a movie that I worked on. And then during that time, the pandemic happened, and I got the chance to make this movie. But I wasn't ready to be freelance yet after making this movie. And so I went back into development, and I became a creative executive at a comedy company called Just for Laughs, where I was developing comedy TV shows around comedians. And it was very fun. But the more and more time I spent there, the more I was getting itchy and desiring trying to get back to this thing that I'd originally set out to do. And that's what I'm doing right now.
And what's next for you? What are you hoping to do next, or what are you working on already?
Yeah, I'm freelancing for the first time since moving to LA, and that is both exciting and terrifying. but mostly it's been really exciting. So there's sort of two buckets. One is freelancing to pay the bills, so that's building up my commercial directing experience. Mm-hmm. That's taking every odd job that comes my way in order to get behind the camera. I'm in post on a two-part docu-series that'll go on PBS next year, so that's kind of keeping me afloat. And then the other bucket besides freelance is I want to make another movie, and that's really the only goal right now. And so I'm building a slate of a couple films that I think are worth doing that are still micro budget movies, but they're also, you know, eight times the budget of this movie. Mm-hmm. And I'm really just focusing on that, because making a feature opens so many doors for you. And it's actually bizarre. I've produced and directed a couple big short films in the last couple years. These are short films with budgets ranging from $15,000 to $35,000. And the amount of work and labor that goes into that is comparable to making a micro budget movie. Mm-hmm. But they open way less doors. And really the calling card that you need to keep progressing is to continue making movies. And so that's the number one goal right now.
Before I turn it over to questions, what's it feel like in this sort of weird out-of-body existential moment for you to come back here, see your professors, not just me, but to come back here and see all of your former professors and come back to campus as a filmmaker who can actually impart a lot of great information, as you have done tonight, to students? I'm just curious what it feels like for you.
I mean, I feel very out-of-body right now. It's surreal. I'm honored. I'm terrified. I feel both. My ego is both inflated and deflated at once. I feel like a fraud, and I feel like a movie star. Like I'm so incredibly honored, and I hope anything I'm saying sounds like English. And and honestly, there's no. I was saying this to you backstage. There's really no better way to close this chapter. Like, I've been working on this movie for 4 years. That's an entire college length amount of time. and yet somehow we actually just finished everything that we need for this project this week. I've been still working on legal deliverables for this movie until this week, and it's actually done now. And there's really no better way to end it than being back here. And I've screened this movie a lot of times, but there's nothing that means as much to me as doing it here.
Well, we're thrilled to have you here. Okay, so we're gonna turn it over to questions. Please raise your hand and a mic will come to you.
Thank you for the discussion, and the film is beautiful. I really related to processing grief through filmmaking, so it was really touching. I love the scene too where they talked about stealing as a way of making movies. So I'm curious what films inspired you for this film or in general?
Yeah, I stole a lot. I stole a lot. We were just talking about this too. There's a couple big influences which I'm sure are felt. This movie was written right after Lady Bird came out, and so, or I guess a couple years after, but there's a lot of that feeling in there. I think that one of the biggest tonal influences by far is Edge of 17, which sometimes I almost feel almost uncomfortable with how much of that voice I hear. But at the same time, too, it's translated into my own perspective and point of view. I love that movie. I love the writing. I love Kelly Freeman Craig. A movie that I actually saw when I was here at the Pollock Theater was Me, Earl, and the Dying Girl, which was also a big reference point in terms of like the home movies and the DIY stuff. I also revisited Be Kind Rewind a couple times to just think about where we could kind of bring that like found object DIY footage feeling into the story. And then I also was just trying to watch a movie a day. A director that I met with a director right before we shot named Andy Fickman, who's done a ton of stuff, including like She's the Man and a bunch of Disney stuff. And he gave me the advice of, when I was in pre-production, to get up every morning an hour and a half early and just watch a movie, which feels so indulgent because you're working on so many things and that it feels wrong to just watch a movie first thing in the morning. But that ended up being an amazing practice because even if the movie wasn't in the same genre, you'd still find those little things. You're like, oh, that is a cool way to shoot that scene. Oh, that would be a fun line. Like, and then we were trying to just put Easter eggs of dialogue in it from different classic movies, some of which I think are obvious, some of which are a little too subtle. Sometimes there's like a weird Pulp Fiction line in there. Every time I hear it, I'm like, nobody gets what this is. But yeah, we were just stealing constantly.
It was so lovely watching this film.
Hi, Salah.
Hi. And so great to see your storytelling on screen. I am most curious, what was your most memorable day on set?
Ooh, I love that question. Also, thank you for driving up from LA to be here.
Of course, I'm happy to.
What was the most memorable day on set? Okay, I'm gonna tell two quick anecdotes. One, on our first day, I'm flipping out. I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm really doing the best that I can, but I've got my director's hat on. I've got that I'm feeling and trying to not let anybody tell that I have no idea what I'm doing and that I'm flipping out underneath it. And the first thing we decided to shoot was the car scenes, and I'd never shot anything like that before, and that's challenging because you're not in the car with them, you're in a follow car, and you're radioing, and hearing them through a sound system that is inevitably cutting in and out and cutting in and out, and I'm trying not to let my director's hat slip, I'm trying to, oh, no, this is normal, I know what I'm doing. But I was stressed, and almost immediately, one of the very first things that happened in this production is we're shooting the shot of Isabel in the car looking at her mom. So it's the profile shot. So what that means is the camera's on a hi-hat out the window of the car, a hostess tray, out the window of the car on Missy's side. So that'd be on the second, she's the driver. Shooting in. And we're driving on these quiet streets during the pandemic. And there's a truck next to the car that juts out further than any of the other cars. And Missy hits the truck, and specifically hits it on the side of our Alexa Mini where that was shooting that shot. So it was actually on the other side. But we didn't break the camera, but we almost broke the camera on like shot three of day one of this movie. But we did break the battery. These are just horror stories that I'm sharing, but there were beautiful moments too. But the other horror story we were talking about backstage, which was on the last day of shooting, when we felt like we were in the clear, on the second to last day of shooting, we shot the entire montage at the beginning, which was a really stressful day because we had to call all of our cast. We had to keep rearranging the house to fit the way it was supposed to look at different time periods. Something you'd never see on camera is that house had a giant grand piano in the living room. So every time we had to shoot something in one space, we had to move the piano to the other space. And then it became like almost like a clown car situation where it's like, we gotta go back to the living room, move the piano. And then you need the whole crew to move the piano. So it was a really stressful day. And then on the last day, we're going off to shoot the scenes in the park, which we were stealing and did not have a permit for. I see my DP sitting in the garage of the house, and he's holding the VHS camera, and there is just VHS tape spewing out of the camera. And I said, Freddie, is that the montage? And he said, yes. And I said, can you fix it? And he said, I don't know. And so there was it really sunk the last day because there was this feeling, did we just lose all of the VHS bits of the film? But everything always ends up working out or happening for a reason because all it ended up doing was distorting the footage that we'd shot on the first day or on that second to last day. And so if you remember all of the distortion from the opening montage, specifically on that last shot of Lydia and her dad on the couch watching TV, all of that distortion was just because the tape got screwed up, and it happened in the perfect place. And so sometimes lucky accidents still happen. So those are two horror stories from the film that ended up being okay.
Hi there. So you mentioned how like there were some like challenges on set and stuff, and you had a line even in the film, I forget it verbatim, but of like sometimes it feels like everything's going wrong, but then eventually you get through, you prevail. What do you think are some of the best ways for you and on other sets you've been on where you've seen people and like how you and those people prevailed through those challenges that felt like larger than life and like there was no way of getting to the other side?
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the biggest, that's like one of the very biggest lessons learned from this film, which is there is, filmmaking is inherently really stressful and things always go wrong and there are always setbacks and there are always miscommunications and frankly, that doesn't get any better when the productions get bigger. I visited set for It Ends With Us, have a lot of friends that are working on bigger and bigger productions, and the reality is the problems just get bigger and harder to solve because there's more bodies, there's more ways that things can get miscommunicated, there's more money on the line. And so if there's one lesson learned through all of that is that there is never a reason to get upset. And there, you can be stressed. It's natural to be stressed. I think it's unrealistic to think that you wouldn't be stressed, but there's never a reason to get angry. There's never a reason to try to look for somebody to blame. It's like the problems are inevitable, and the best people at getting through them, the most talented, the best filmmakers to be around in those circumstances are the ones that don't let it get to them, that keep a clear head, that aren't reactionary, and just go, okay, how do we solve this? Because there will be a solution, even if that solution is that you have to pause for a couple hours, even if that solution is you're going to have an uncomfortable conversation with somebody about money. Nothing is going to be the end of the world. We're making movies. There's no, you know, person that we're saving here, even if we're saving them spiritually. There's always going to be a way through. And the calmer you can be and the more you can take every setback with a grain of salt, the better off it'll be.
Long time ago, we had Greg Araki, and one of the things he said was, if I had $100,000 to make a movie, I would rather make 10 $10,000 movies, right? So I'm asking you, if you had $10 million, would you rather make a $10 million movie or 10 $1 million movies? Because the freedom, what you were talking about, the freedom of doing stuff.
I love that question. And I'm going to answer it maybe almost too sincerely. If I had $10 million, I would probably make 3 movies. I would make $1 million movie, one $3 million movie, and one $6 million movie. And and that's just in the interest of giving yourself more shots on goal. But I wouldn't, if I had $100,000, I would not make 10 $10,000 movies. That makes sense. Because I do think, unfortunately, that the amount of money we made this movie for, it's challenging to say it's the minimum, because the reality is you'll find ways to make it work at any budget level, but it's very difficult to make a movie for less money than we made it for if you're going to do it SAG, if you're going to do it legally, or at least like quasi-legally. Perhaps not everybody's getting paid, but most people are getting paid minimum wage. And you want to do finishing steps like sound and color and not just have it die on a hard drive somewhere. It's really difficult to make it for less money than this. Now, that being said, if you have your own camera, if you want to do it really, go really rogue, film something with your own camera and your friends acting and you're going to edit yourself, then yeah, absolutely, you could make something for less money than this. But to do it in the way that we did it, this is definitely the floor. So I would love $100,000 to make one $100,000 movie. But if you know anybody with $10 million and they're interested in a slate of 3, I'm all ears.
So now you've made the movie. So now what's the distribution path and are you involved in that?
Yeah. So the unusual thing about the timing of this is the movie has been sold and it's been released. It was a very long road getting from completing the film to sale, with a couple setbacks in terms of festivals, in terms of legal, in terms of... We sold the movie to our distributor, which is Grindstone Entertainment, which is a subsidiary of Lionsgate, in January. I think we were closing the deal in like January or February of 2023. And so I'm going, great. The movie's going to come out sometime in like June, July. Yes, it's been a long time, but it'll only be like 2.5, maybe 3 years between shooting it and it coming out. But nobody tells you how much work goes into delivering a movie. And in all of the legal business affairs, very complicated steps that come after sale. And I had nobody that was working on that besides me. And so that ended up becoming something that took place throughout all of 2023. And the distributor told us we were actually not going to be releasing this until April of 2024. So it came out in April. It was on VOD. It was like rentable on Amazon. And then a couple months ago, I looked up the movie and it had appeared on Paramount Plus. So it's currently streaming on Paramount Plus and sometimes also appears on the Movie Channel because the Movie Channel is owned by Paramount. So it's out there and now it's just about helping people find it and then trying to make the next one.
And how much does that go back to your casting, do you think?
Oh, I definitely think it's a huge part of it. Because Paramount Plus is where you can watch Yellowstone 1883. And Miss Isabel May is the lead of that film, or that show.
So it all goes back to pre-production.
Yes. Pre-production is the best. It's the best phase.
Absolutely. It's all promise and hope.
Yes. Oh, in pre-production, the movie's perfect, and it won Cannes, and you got an Oscar, like, and you're the youngest film, like, wow. And then reality sets in, and then there's a low phase of post-production where you get really depressed at the first cut, and then you build back up in joy, and then you submit it to Sundance, and then there's a low again. That's the roller coaster.
Well, I have to say, thank you so much for joining us. It was amazing to have you here. Thank you so much for this amazing film and sharing this with everyone here. We're so proud of you.
Thank you, guys. This is the delight of my life.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.